And he'll be telling us a little bit about multi-channel in SMB3.
Yes, thank you. So yeah, everybody who is not speaking German, feel free to call me Michael, which I'm used to being addressed as. Yes, I'm working for Red Hat these days and working there in a different organization than the people that the speakers we've heard so far from Red Hat. I'm working in Red Hat Storage, which is a relatively new subdivision. We are working on software-defined scale-out storage there, including Samba as a NAS head on top of distributed file systems. Currently, primarily GlusterFS, but increasingly also CephFS. And yeah, I'm working there in the SMB team, which is mainly responsible for Samba and its integration with the storage backends, Gluster and Ceph. And so this is the first talk of a series of talks from my team. We'll also hear Günther, who will talk tomorrow about different efforts we're doing there with cluster integration. Also, Jose will be giving an overview about integration efforts of our Samba clustering, CDB clustering with a common pacemaker setup, which will be an interesting take. And we'll hear from Ira about the current status of integration with CephFS. So my talk will be exclusively upstream facing a Samba talk. It will not cover any specifics about any of the backends. It's a genuine SMB talk. And yeah, SMB3 multi-channel in Samba now really. So, I mean, you can ask, hey, this guy has been speaking about multi-channel for a while. And so is this any different now? Hopefully a little bit at least. We'll see as we move along. Okay, does this work? It works. Hey, Samba XP right in front of the hotel. So a little bit of intro. No, on the other hand side. It's not a window behind the, yeah. Okay, a little bit. So this is about SMB. I was wondering what SMB is. Sanitätshaus Müller-Betten. So, or server message block. So the mini history about SMB, quite interesting to see for our purposes. It was mentioned before SMB created around 1983 by Barry Feigenbaum and IBM, or designed. It was then taken on by Microsoft also for various products and greatly extended and enhanced. It was in the LAN manager product, Windows for Workgroups in the 90s, early 90s. Then at some point there was an effort to rename SMB to CIFS, Common Internet File System, in the mid-90s, but later this was abandoned again. Nowadays we luckily have a consistent naming scheme of these protocol versions. SMB1 was until roughly, Windows 2, year 2006, when SMB version 2 was first introduced. Then we had SMB version 2.1 with Windows 7, and so we see the new version, SMB3, and the subversion thereof since 2012. So this is almost 6 years or 3.5 years by now. What about Samba? If you look back at these versions, I'll talk more about the content of the changes in these versions a little bit in a minute. But so what about Samba? So a little bit of Samba history. Samba, as Simo has already mentioned today, was started in 1991 or 92, whatever way you would like to see it, as an SMB server at some point, as an effort to re-implement this protocol on Unix-like systems. And then I marked in blue the instances where we see the newer versions of SMB appearing. So here we have in 2010 an experimental version of SMB 2.0. In 2011 with Samba 3.6, we declared it stable. It was complete except for one arguably bigger feature, the so-called durable file handles, which were then added in 2012 with the advent of Samba 4.0. So these kinds of things we see. In 2012 we also had SMB 2.1 and 3.0 basic support. And this means that apart from the great publicity that the Samba 4.0 release has become due to the Active Directory domain controller being first made available, it was also a big release file server-wise. And then, quite some time later, in 2015, we essentially more or less completed the SMB 2.1 implementation by adding the last missing pieces, the so-called leases. And, this should be 16. Apologies. No, that was late 17, 15. That's true. We changed to a 6-month release schedule recently. So this was late or September 2015. We added support for these minor updates of the SMB protocol. So, right. And now, what this is about, in 2016, we at least released experimental support for the so-called multi-channel feature of SMB 3. So, my apologies. Tom already pointed that out to me. I kept misspelling multi-channel because for me it was like, aha, I put a hyphen in between, but in the Microsoft documents, wherever you look, you'll find it as a single word. And I, at some point I chose, I'll keep spelling it like this. People will know what I mean, right? And I also like it more. I don't know, I keep doing this. So now I was like, hey, we implemented this protocol. And then, aha, but later we added another feature of that protocol. So how can that be done? It can be done by so-called capabilities that can be negotiated in the SMB2 negotiate request, which initiates the connection between server and client. So there are a couple of these capabilities. The DFS capability, distributed file server, was implemented since long ago, since the beginning. The large MTU of SMB, so this is the large MTU feature basically of SMB 2.1 was implemented in 4.0. The encryption capability of SMB 3 transport encryption was already implemented in Samba 4.0. The leasing capability, as I mentioned, was released in Samba 4.2. And now with 4.4, we have the multi-channel capability of SMB 3. And there are two big red items here, which are not implemented yet, the directory leasing and the persistent handles capability. So these are really nice. I mean, you can just offer parts of the protocol and the client and server agree on what's available and what can be used. So that's why we could do it. There are some more aspects to it. There are other more or less optional features. Some are related to so-called create contexts, which are more or less okay to ignore. For instance, the mentioned durable file handles, which is a best effort concept. If a client requests durable file handles via such a context, it's okay not to give it a durable handle back, but just a regular file handle. Or there are some other aspects like the ioctls or FSCTLs, which may be okay to return error on when a client requests that. I mean, sometimes we have seen bugs, but we have gotten away with that so far.
That first FS control is the multi-channel query.
Yeah, right, the client, so we relied on the fact that the client will only ask it if it had negotiated multi-channel before. Right. The resiliency request is not protected by a capability, so that's a different animal. But yeah, so, well, we have talked about resiliency, it's not the point. But I wanted to create the impression a little bit of what this whole scenario of SMB versions and features is about. So so what's the big deal? We've seen there was this encryption capability we had from the beginning. Then we mentioned multi-channel. And so what was the big deal? I mean, we had SMB version 1, version 2, 2.1, and then SMB version 3 sometime later. So the big deal was that it firstly introduced clustering of the SMB service, essentially with certain aspects. The actual HA aspect with fast failover due to witness servers, go to Günther's talk. Continuous availability with persistent file handles that give strong guarantees on reconnecting to an open file, and scale out, so all active access over a clustered installation. That was a very, very new thing, and that also kind of, Samba was doing clustered all active stuff since roughly 2009, I think. So now it's rooted in the protocol and it's all different. And additionally, as I said, transport encryption, multi-channel, and using RDMA as a transport. So, which is also called SMB Direct. So of all these things, currently, okay, this was a relatively minor thing. It was not optional. It was implemented in Samba 4.0 from the start. Multi-channel is the only of the other things that is now available in Samba upstream code, but the others are being worked on. So what was the scope, basically? Scope was mainly changing from mainly workstation kind of workload to server workload, putting databases and virtualization images into the SMB storage instead of having it on block storage for various reasons, which I'm not going to elaborate on here. But that was so the setting, SMB3. Right. So much for the general introduction. And now we're getting a little more serious. So no alcohol at this point. I always love this. So, I mean, it doesn't make sense mathematically. Unless you're on a one-dimensional space, there is no beyond a point. It's I don't like it. That's why I always take pictures of these things when I see it. Okay. This, all the features I mentioned are really big features which require big rewrites and big changes in Samba. This is the first one that is more or less ready. About the readiness, I'll detail in a bit. So what is multi-channel about? It is about binding multiple transport connections into one authenticated SMB session. Such a connection bound to a session is called a channel in SMB speak. The decision which connections to bind to a session is upon the client. And the important point is that such a session will be valid. This is part of the guarantees and the properties of the protocol extensions will be valid unless at least one of the channels is valid. So that means this thing it can increase the throughput of an SMB session by aggregating traffic over multiple connections, and it can increase the fault tolerance. So in a traditional SMB session, when a connection fails, the client has to reconnect, reestablish, and if the client is lucky to have had durable or even persistent file handles, it can get access to the open files again. In a multi-channel connection, all the channels have to fail until this happens. Before that, every single file handle and everything IOs in flight will be still valid, and that's the big win. So. And it's also the prerequisite, technically, for the very interesting RDMA feature. So RDMA, when it's implemented, is implemented by first doing a TCP connection and then binding an additional RDMA channels onto the existing session. So it's technically a prerequisite. Yeah, Thomas commented that the throughput is really important, even for pure TCP channel bonding. I mean, Microsoft had demonstrated that when they first launched it at the software developer storage developer conference in Santa Clara in 2012, like first binding multiple 10 gig TCP connections and later replacing that with a RDMA connection, and you could see very good throughputs with varying amounts of CPU load. But yeah, I'm sure the features have multiplied by then, but yeah, I'm not able to give such an impressive performance demo here, but let's concentrate on the technical details. So, use cases. So what the client does is usually it binds multiple sessions, multiple connections to the session, and it then usually chooses, this is a client logic, really the server just provides what interfaces are available, the server chooses which to use. So even if many, many connections are bound to one session, the client usually uses only the fastest one. So if you bind 4 1 gigabit Ethernet connections and 1 10 gigabit, you will most probably just see traffic on that 1 10 gigabit Ethernet, unless it dies and then it falls over to the remaining active 4 1 gigabit Ethernet connections, something like that. Or if you have 4 10 gig Ethernet connections and then you have an RDMA InfiniBand connection, probably that will be used due to the lower latency. Okay. So how does it work? How is a multi-channel session established? So first establish an initial session on a TCP connection. then there is a special request. This I already mentioned, FSCTL query network interface info. It retrieves the interfaces from the server, and the server specifies the characteristics like speed and type and RSS capability, etc. And then the client chooses to bind additional TCP or later RDMA connections to the session as a channel. And this process is done using an extension of the existing session setup request, which is so-called session bind. So it is a session setup request with a binding flag set to true or set to one, and also specifying the previous session ID, which has been established in the initial session setup. Okay, important in a cluster, even in a Windows cluster, the client only binds to addresses on a given node. So these multi-channel connections are not like PNFS spreading across nodes. To the best of my knowledge, in all available implementation, this always goes to a single physical host. And there are so-called replay and retry mechanisms and sequence numbers in place in order to protect from channel failure. These, the most important problems to solve in this case are what happens when, while we have been sending out a request, the client has been sending out a request to the server, the connection dies and it doesn't get a reply. So either the request could have reached the server or it may not. And so this, there are these mechanisms. So sequence numbers and some replay operation flags in the protocol are used to detect or to determine whether a request that the client is resending on a different channel is such a replay operation. And if the server then detects, okay, this must have been a channel failure and I'm receiving this thing again, I have already processed the create call, so I'm just replying as if it would be the initial request, something like that. These mechanisms. These are the nitty-gritty details of the protocol. It is all documented in the protocol specification, the MS-SMB2 document. All, let's say, except for a couple of details, which I'm going to mention later. So, what about Samba? This was the general protocol and the explanation of what the Windows client does. What can Samba do? Well, there is the architectural principle of Samba file server SMBD currently. We have one main SMBD process, and it for each TCP connection, it creates a child process, which is then exclusively responsible for this TCP connection. So there's a one-to-one correspondence between SMBD processes and TCP connections. This has been there since the beginning. Oops, sorry. Wait, what's that? Doesn't work. That's broken. Well, I could fix the LaTeX, but I don't. The idea is there is this thing called FD passing. We can send messages from one process to another, and a TCP connection is just an open file descriptor. It's a socket, and we can pass that from one daemon to another. So the idea is. This is bad if we end up in a different process. We don't want it. Because, these are accessing disks and there are IOs coming in from via these channels. Ah, it wasn't even a bug. Excuse me. The unfolding will come afterwards. So if we send IOs to both processes, they'd have to coordinate in the POSIX disk file access. And in order to circumvent this, there is a danger of data corruption or stuff getting out of sync. And so the idea is transfer this thing to the existing SMBD. So like this, there is the established channel session, new connection, and then we have the session bind. We pass this connection over to the other SMBD, and then we have a second channel, and the IO path to the disk is just this. Okay. So how do we do it? We use FD passing. When? Natural choice would be in the session setup request. After serious consideration and also discussion with Microsoft, since it's done differently, of course, their about the assumptions. We chose to do it in the first possible request, namely when the negotiate request comes in, which is the first SMB request. And this request already provides something called client GUID. We can identify the client by this first request. And so the thought we came up with was, well, move it as early as possible. If we do it later, probably other stuff has already been done in the process. So there is more state to be taken care of. If it's just the first SMB request, just move it over there. So we essentially are moving toward a per client GUID or per client single process model. So this is how it looks in a diagram. Time goes down. So first, client connects. SMBD forks a child one, the negotiate goes back and forth, session setup goes back and forth. Now the connection is done, a second child is created, negotiate request comes in, oh, there's this client GUID, we find this child one process which already served the same GUID, we pass it over, this process can go away, and the reply is already sent from the child one. We then do the session, then the session setup bind request already ends up in this process and is replied from there. So that is our current model. Single process essentially for the client GUID. What about performance? As we've seen in the first diagram, we just have a single path to disk, but we do short-lived helper threads for I/O operations, and so we do use multiple CPUs here. Tests and benchmarkings are in the progress, so no data yet, but stay tuned. So there may be another talk covering multi-channel in a bit of time. Okay, so what's the real status? Just very briefly, these are all the elements we had to do or have to do. So we had to rewrite our messaging system to use Unix datagram sockets with send message capabilities to be able to pass FDs at all. So that was done quite some time ago, mainly by Volker. We had to add FD passing to the messaging that was included in 4.2. So most of the work is in collaboration with Stefan Metzmacher and Volker in the preparations mainly, and we have in the recent months I've been working with Günther, and other people have helped as well. So we had all the preparations of the internal structures we had to reshuffle. This is all done between 4.2 and 4.4. We had to prepare the code to cope with multiple channels at all. So the assumptions of having a single TCP connections were rooted quite deeply. A lot of cleanup work to be done. The message to actually pass the TCP socket and do it triggered by the negotiate call with a client GUID lookup. All that has been done. It's in 4.4. We have implemented the session bind request. It's in 4.4. We have implemented the channel sequence number checks, it's also there, has just been pushed, it's not released, we just observed that we not forgot, but we lost track of this bug, so there's a patch set, it will be in the next 4.4 release, it's in Upstream Master. The interface discovery, this network interface info thing, has been implemented in two ways. On Linux, we can retrieve it from the kernel with the ETH tool, iOctl, and for other systems where we don't yet have implementation, we can use an explicit hard-coded configuration to provide the interface details, speed, etc. Test cases, okay, that's always work in progress. A lot of them have been added already, and many more of them are in work in progress branches and are still being worked on. Okay, there is to do and work in progress stuff. So in order to run these things, these test cases we have written in our self-test suite, which is also the push gate for our master branch, we have to implement FD passing in our socket wrapper, which is, there's a design, it's still needs to be done, and very importantly, we have to implement lease break replay. I will come to that in a bit. But before I address the to-dos a little more seriously, okay, how have we gotten there? So the preparations that were already in 4.2 and earlier, these preparations I mean, I did a count of a couple of patches. I mean, these were probably many, many more if you count all the prerequisites like the messaging rewrite, etc. But the real preparations, shuffling around the structures, they were there. And since summer 2015, we were able to really concentrate on getting this stuff forward. So we had this huge work in progress branch, mainly based on work by Metz and myself. And so the polishing work was quite extensive. We had to add new stuff also. The create replay was not implemented yet. The interface detection wasn't there. So we added that stuff. And in units, we merged it. It overall is quite a number of patches that have gone in, and these are the people who have mainly contributed. So we just made it as an experimental feature into Samba 4.4. Why experimental? Oh, it's due to this thing mainly missing, implement least break replay. So I'll raise the tension a little bit about that thing, because so just two glimpses. About the prerequisite work, so the actual message to pass a connection is really simple. We have the time, we have the actual client GUID that we want to look for, and we have a data blob, which is the negotiate request. So the whole request that came in as a negotiate is just passed on, so the receiving daemon can reply to it. So that was one thing, one example, and the other is reshuffling of the structures. We had to create the notion of a client, actually. The client connected to the server. Before that, that was in one-to-one correspondence with a TCP connection, and so we had to generalize this. We introduced a new layer, so the session has an associated SMB client, meaning the client connected to us, and this has an array of connections that are the channels of this session. So just very briefly, a short shell breakout I wanted to show to just give you an idea. Is this legible? So there is a list of, I mean, I just took all the patches that were responsible for adding this feature, and let's go back to where the prerequisite, where is it? Sorry. Okay, here. This is the work that basically started in last summer. So quite a number of patches for the preparations. So the biggest part was the actual implementation of the session binds, so some preparations, looking up where is the client, is there any SMBD that already serves it, second step, another preparatory authentication changes. We had this we add a channel to an existing session, etc. And then we had the implementation of the bind request. So you see it's all like bigger groups of patches. And then you have a bigger hunk here, which is the actual SMBD connection passing implementation with a couple of preparations. So it's probably not complete, but that's the core of it. And here we have, among other refactorings and preparations, we have the create replay, which is the top block here. That was all, as you can see here, this was relatively new code, not stemming from older work. And here is the channel sequence number checking, and more test case fixes. So just to give you a rough idea, this is just a number of patches. And I can also, for instance, show you like the connection passing, for instance. So there's the git diff. It's, well, and this doesn't even include test cases for this. So this is, I mean, by no means it's even near the size of changes for Bedlock and related security patches. But so each of these steps I can't give a combined git diff here, but these are really, so here you see the code, if EDH tool is available, how we query this stuff, and so on. Let me just jump back, so not to waste too much time on that. It's all in the upstream repository. And let's get back. Okay, instructions. I mean, it's there. How to actually use it? Well, it's not that complicated, actually. It's more easy than crossing a light. You just add server multi-channel support equals yes. And if you are on a non-Linux system, you better also add this special configuration, which is a little more complicated, which it's in the man page, man.smb.conf. It's there. But this is the, on Linux, that's as much as it takes. Okay. There's no hyphen. That's true. But we could omit the space here. Somebody commented, I mean, this is... yeah. So, that's true. I should, in all honesty, should have put in hyphen here. right, maybe. It's too late. It's already landed. We can rename it. We can add an alias. Yeah. Okay. So, now the to-dos.
Very important.
Yeah, cosmetics is always important. So there are the to-dos. I want to just recap them. So teach socket wrapper FD passing, replay lease breaks upon channel failure. So there is danger here, and this is important. This is the one case which kind of is different from the usual flow. The usual flow is the client sends a request to the server, server replies. And for these things, the protection mechanisms like channel sequence numbers, the replay flags and all that kind is in the protocol, it's in the documentation, it's even implemented in Samba. But the uplock or lease break, the server sends actively to the client and the client has to respond. So this is completely the other way around and there is no protocol-rooted protection mechanism for that. The protocol document says, well, I mean, if you don't get a reply and maybe there's a broken... It's not a precise quotation, but roughly it says, yeah, try on other channels if the channel was broken. And basically try until there's either a reply or no channel left. And this is still to do. The second thing, which is also dangerous but more specific, is that it doesn't integrate well currently with our clustering. So in clustering, we have the concept of these floating addresses. CDB calls them public IP addresses. Where is it here? Public addresses. So channels, as I said, should go just to one node. And we have to make sure that this will happen. We have the public IPs, which are also called virtual IPs or floating IPs in other HA scenarios. They can move from one node to another. That's why I say floating IPs or virtual IPs. I mean these IPs that can move.
Not necessarily. That's what I'm saying. They don't have to move.
They can move. So these are IPs that can move in the cluster. The problem is not that they move every time or every second, but there are scenarios which may be safe, but the standard setup of CDDB and the usual way people want to do HA with a scale-out cluster is they want to have a set of addresses, the constant set of addresses they can connect to any of those addresses and land on one node of the cluster. And so in this default mode, CDDB moves these. When node fails, moves an IP over, and when another node comes back up, it may even move, depending on configuration, move an IP back. You can disable it all, that's true. You can even not use public addresses at all. That's possible, that's completely viable. But if you have them, there's a danger because it moves, and what happens to the multi-channel session in that case? So, and the problem, so why is this a problem? It's a problem because, I mean, why doesn't Microsoft have a problem with Windows clustering? Because our CDB clustering is completely transparent to the client. To the client doesn't know whether it connects to a multi-home machine or to a cluster. So, you have to do some tedious stuff there. So what to do? There are the instructions, the safety instructions, how to wash your hands and how to do it. Well, we have to establish a list of allowed addresses on a cluster node, allowed addresses for multi-channel. So, for instance, we can query the public addresses from CDDB, is one possible thing, or other means. Even configure it in smb.conf, it would be an option, like use the cluster addresses config line. There are options, it's not implemented, it's a plan, or possibilities. We can also add static, or should, of course, because those should not be used. We should add static addresses to the interfaces, the client-facing interfaces. We can even optionally establish a whitelist in the configuration. anyhow, we will end up with a list of addresses allowed on a node allowed for multi-channel. And then what to do? So we should only publish with this network interface ioctl, we should only publish allowed addresses when a request comes in on such an allowed address. If instead we get the interface info ioctl on such a moving address, we just reply with the same address and you don't care. So just don't give the other addresses. This is to be implemented, and then deny session bind on non-allowed addresses. That's the other thing. You can do initial session setup on a public or a floating address, but you can't do a session bind with it. So these protections need to be implemented. And it's mainly because of, just a second, it's mainly because of this, and especially also the upload break replay thing, that we called the release, the feature in the protocol release, experimental. Question, Amitai?
So since this configuration is not the standard CTDB cluster configuration, we can have static IPs configured per node. They don't have to be floating. Sure. And that sort of gets you what you really want.
Yeah, but in that case, the only remaining point, as far as I understand it, of public addresses is the TickleX.
Sorry, is there?
The TickleX.
Right.
So otherwise, you could just put static addresses and... So there are two points for public addresses. With a floating aspect, it's like you want to put the whole set of public addresses behind one DNS name so that it can be uniformly addressed. If you stick them to nodes, this advantage or this aspect goes away. The other aspect is that for public addresses, TCP tracks the connection, CTDB tracks the connections and does a TickleX.
Sorry, I don't understand the point.
What's the point in? I mean, of course we can do static addresses, but you are also referring to like public addresses that don't move.
Yeah. So if you configure public addresses per node, which are different, then they will always stick to that node.
Yes.
And they are always tracked as public addresses, so you get all the benefits of TickleX and everything.
Yeah, no. The main benefit I see is, I mean, yes, TickleX is important, and that aspect remains, but the other, the HA aspect, is gone. So it's a reduced usefulness.
Sure.
So, and it's not the default thing people do. We can also discuss more during the rest of the conference. But let me just go on and wrapping up. What will come next? So, finishing moves for the multi-channel. So the plan is to have it in Samba 4.5, which is due to our plan, according to our plans, going to be released in September. So hopefully we have a stable feature there. If no other like bad luck kind of thing comes in between. We are working on the SMB witness service, which is the core bit of the clustering feature. I plan to next address the persistent handles feature, the continuously available continuous availability feature. Then there are plans and to implement RDMA, and one very important topic is always multi-protocol access, and or as an alternative, we are also advertising to use SMB on every client instead of using multiple clients to solve the same problem, namely the problem of heterogeneous client environment. So SMB Unix extensions are required for that and for version 2. And so go to see Jeremy's talk tomorrow, which will be a great talk about that topic. So that's my talk. And so if I have another like 2 minutes, you can decide to ask questions or to see a demo. Tom asked a question.
Thank you.
Well, I'd love to see a demo, but I do have a question.
Yes.
Because of the file descriptor handoff, it seems to me it used to be you'd have one SMBD per connection.
Yes.
Now you have one SMBD per client.
Yes.
So when Windows clients actually share connections across sessions, does that become awkward for your SMBD?
Sure.
Right. When they go to connect to a server,
yes,
with a new principal, right, a new identity that's going to,
yeah,
authenticate with the server,
yeah,
they'll look for an existing connection to the server,
oh,
and they'll attempt to reuse that connection. They'll
but
put multiple
will,
sessions.
Well, yeah. I mean, there's like, yeah, but
SMB2 multi-channel doesn't.
Isn't that using the same client GUID?
Well, yeah, you're looking to the client good to be more unique than it may actually be.
Yeah, we've discussed that. You kind of said to me, yeah, it's not documented, but Windows clients will do that.
I'd have to go look at when we regenerated
GUID. I know, I can't sue you for that. That's for granted. But so I also see possible problems with terminal servers or something like that, possibly. I don't know. So yeah. I haven't had real problems yet.
Okay. We should talk about the scenarios, because...
The demo, yeah, but the demo, of course, doesn't do it. So the demo, in my abstract, I said I will have a demo of latest code. Okay, in full honesty, it's not a demo of latest code. We have enough time for a demo of... demo... Well, where is it? Come on. Here it is. Demo. Yeah, of course. Video. No way. Okay, so we have a Windows 2012 R2 in this case, as you can see here. Hurry, hurry. We have like 5 Ethernet interfaces. Some of them are 10 gigabit, actually, many of them, and one is just a 1 gigabit interface, and it's the one you saw first. And now we have a Samba server. Okay, I can forward a little. I think. I need that. We have Samba server with no... Oh, hey, we have the interfaces here, the various interfaces on the Samba server. This one is the slow one, the 1 gigabit. The others are 10 gigabit interfaces. And so now what we're doing is we're starting Samba, which includes the multi-channel. So where is it? It should go slower. Okay, come on, that's the work in progress branches still here. No SMB process there. In this case, I'm running out of a Git tree and not from a compiled package. Okay, now I'm watching netstat, so to see which connections are there. It's just the SSH connection at this point. And now in Windows, we go there and if the thing would go away, we are doing net use. There is no share connected. And we are now establishing a share connection. An initial share connection to that host. Share one. Some user, some password, and we're connected. So we have an initial port 445 connection on that address that I gave up here, which is the slow one. We have an SMBD over here with a certain PID. And now we do a listing in that share that doesn't do anything, but we see what is the multi-channel connections there. It has already registered all the other addresses. It just didn't use them yet, didn't do traffic over them. But when I do more than LS, if I do a copy of a bigger file, it will start using them, as we will see in a second. Now, copy big file to the share. And now, here, immediately, we see the connections popping up and traffic only on the fast ones, not on the slow one. And you see here, you have all the same PID. So it really ends up in one process, which is completely different from usual traditional Samba without multi-channel. That's actually it. Thank you very much for your thanks.